Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Finding true love is hard. Finding the perfect New York City apartment, basically impossible. Liz Moore got lucky with the apartment, but then a crush complicated things. You know Julia Stiles from the Jason Bourne series and the 90s classic 10 Things I Hate About You. She's starring in Riviera, a miniseries that premiered in the U.S. on Sundance Now. Julia reads Liz Moore's essay, A Family Fairy Tale, Twice Told.
Mac and I met on Craigslist, but not in the usual way. At the time, I was 22, manically conducting the sputtering finale of a relationship I wasn't ready for, and living in my first post-college apartment, the type of place one rarely finds in a lifetime, at least in New York. Two floors at the top of a converted brownstone in Park Slope, Brooklyn, half a block from Prospect Park, and ridiculously inexpensive. It came with four bedrooms, two bathrooms, a winding staircase, up which box springs did not fit, and a roof deck with a view of the Statue of Liberty. It also came with three roommates, one of whom moved out a few months after I moved in. We placed an ad, and several dozen people answered it. Mac was among them. And Mac, as he likes to tell it, sealed the deal. I remember interviewing him. He was wearing a giant, absurd, striped hat, a sort of trapper hat, I think, that he didn't remove throughout the interview. And he seemed very congenial and soft-spoken and Southern in some way. He's from Philadelphia. And also, very funny. When he left, one of my roommates looked at me and said, "Him." And that is the story of how Mac came to live with us. The story of what happened next is not as tidy. First, my boyfriend and I broke up. Walking home after that bad evening, I was crying so hard that I could barely compose myself before entering the apartment. It was Mac who saw me first, Mac who had known me for all of 1 month. "Hi," I said, with as much false cheer as I could muster, and with what I can only imagine in retrospect was a frightening look in my eye. "Are you okay?" asked Mac, as any normal person would. "No," I shouted, and ran to my room, which was turret-like and nookish, with a gabled window and what sounded like a family of squirrels living under the slanted floorboards of the closet. A bout of stomach flu immediately set in. With the exception of going to work, I didn't come out for weeks. When I did, it was almost spring. And there was Mac, still wearing his funny striped hat, a bit more outspoken, still refreshingly kind. Only now he asked me if I wanted to play chess sometimes. When I got home late at night, he asked me if I wanted him to make me a sandwich. And suddenly, we began exchanging several emails per workday. At first, about apartment-related things, and then other kinds of emails. Joke-telling emails. The kind that only lead to one thing. Stifled laughter. And stifled laughter, as everyone knows, leads to one thing. A crush. That's the only word for it. I had a big, huge crush on my roommate. I imagined my eyes as cartoon hearts, my tongue a Tex Avery wolf tongue, my hands tied by the truth, universally acknowledged, that dating one's roommate is a very stupid thing to do. An irresponsible thing to do, even for a 22-year-old. And all of my life, I have been nothing if not responsible. "It's not too late," I told myself sternly. "You can turn this around." I began leaving in the morning before he woke up, so we'd avoid taking the subway together. But we found other ways to see each other. We'd go out, the two of us, to the movies, to play pool. We'd stay up and talk after our roommates Kristen and George had gone to bed. We went to a concert with one of my friends from college. She looked at me, and then him, and then me. "You love him," she whispered. Yes, I had a certified crush on Mac. But I also had an incredible apartment, the sort that allowed me to brag about my rent. This was no small thing in New York. Being relentlessly pessimistic by nature, I figured it probably wouldn't work out with Mac. But a beautiful, underpriced apartment could bring me joy for years. If Mac and I got together and then broke up, one of us was going to have to move out, and I didn't want to be on the wrong side of that coin flip. Eventually, we gave in, and over the course of a night out and a cab ride home, we confessed our feelings for one another, dumping them into the fraught space between us and letting them settle there. And after that, there was no turning back. Mac was calm about it. I was not. I made him promise not to tell Kristen and George, who I felt certain would hate us. Who wants to live with a couple? At first, we were four individuals on equal turf. Now Mac and I were forming an alliance. There was a lot of sneaking around for the first couple of weeks, complicated by the fact that I lived on the top floor and Mac lived on the bottom. Furthermore, I began to feel self-conscious about being home when he was home. I invented places to be after work so that I wouldn't be sitting at home when Mac walked in the door. "This is too weird," I complained to a friend. "It's like moving in with someone after your first date." The worst night was about a month after our mutual confession. Kristen had made dinner. Mac was working late but was going to join us at some point. I tried not to look at the clock too often. We finished eating, still no Mac. I sent him a covert text message that went unanswered. Before Kristen went to bed, she noted that Mac hadn't made it. "Maybe he's got a secret date," she said. I stuttered. That was it, I decided. Mac had a date. Of course he did. I couldn't sleep until I heard his key in the door at 3 in the morning. He told me he had fallen asleep on the F train, twice, ending up in Coney Island and then in Queens. "This isn't going to work," I told him. "I don't know what I was thinking." The next day, distraught and overtired, I called my mother and tearfully confessed my situation to her. "What am I doing?" I asked her. "The same thing your father and I did." It was only then that I registered, through the haze of my youthful self-absorption, the significance of my own parents' meeting. The same story that was told over and over to me as a child, a sort of personal fairy tale. My father, recently divorced, appearing on the doorstep of the big shared house on Cornell Street in Newton, Massachusetts, in response to a classified ad in the back of the paper. My mother opening the door to find a handsome man measuring the width of the doorframe. He was making sure his piano would fit, the nerd. The match. The two of them sneaking around so the other roommates wouldn't find out until one day they came clean. The rest, history. My history, to be precise. "But that's different," I told her. "How?" "I don't know. You guys were hippies. You were practically living in a commune. It was expected." Generously, she ignored me. And over the course of that phone call, I came to several conclusions. That, for my sanity, I would have to give up the apartment and move out. That because it was the decent thing to do, I would tell my roommates about Mac and me. And that, despite my anxiety, despite, or because of, his funny striped hat, I really, definitely liked Mac. And that after I moved out, I was going to try to make something work. That was 6 years ago. Mac stayed in the apartment for another year, through a series of transient replacements for me, none of whom worked out. "You ruined everything," our roommate George once said to Mac darkly. Shortly after, Mac and I nervously moved back in together, this time into a one-bedroom in Ditmas Park. And then, less nervously, to Philadelphia, where we live now, and where we bought our first home this December. As a sort of existential torture, I sometimes used to wonder as a child what would have happened if my father's piano hadn't fit through the door on Cornell Street. Answer? I wouldn't be around to wonder. Today, I do the same with my own story. What would have happened if I had given up on Mac because of his subway-induced narcolepsy? Or because I was too self-conscious to admit my feelings for him? Or because I'd convinced myself that dating my roommate would be a mistake? Answer? I'd probably still be living in that beautiful, cheap, once-in-a-lifetime apartment on Prospect Park. By myself.
Julia Stiles reading Liz Moore's essay, A Family Fairy Tale, Twice Told. We'll find out what happened next for Liz and Mac after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Welcome back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Liz and Mac are married now and still live in the house they bought together in Philadelphia. Liz says that she doesn't think their story is especially out of the ordinary, but it's exceptional to her.
This sounds totally cheesy. I've never believed in love at first sight, except for that one moment when I actually saw Mac walking into the room, which he loves to tease me about because he says that he did not feel that same emotion upon seeing me. It grew on him more slowly, let's say.
Liz and Mac have a daughter. She's 17 months old. Liz says that having a child is the most beautiful and most stressful thing that has ever happened to her relationship. And she's looking forward to telling her daughter her own origin story someday.
I think when my daughter's old enough to speak in full sentences, she might ask how her dad and I met. And what's cool is a friend of ours actually contacted the artist who did the illustration for the piece in the Times to request a print and had it framed and gave that to us as a present. So it's now hanging in our upstairs hallway. So what we will actually be able to do with our daughter is give her an illustrated lesson in how her parents met by pointing to that and saying, you know, this is Mom and this is Dad. She lived upstairs and he lived downstairs and that's how they met.
In addition to the artwork, Liz says that her modern love piece is also a reminder that the most practical decision isn't always the right one. She says that tension between what feels right and what seems pragmatic is always present in her mind.
Deciding whether to go toward the thing that I'm afraid of has been the running theme of my entire adult existence and probably my childhood too. Whether it's deciding whether or not to date my roommate, as the case may be, or whether it's to, like, take a risk professionally to leave a stable job for a job that offers certain other opportunities but might be riskier. it was nice in a way to write this piece because it allowed me to reflect on one particular turning point in my life where if I hadn't taken what I assumed to be the wrong or the riskier decision, my life would have worked out a lot differently and potentially I wouldn't have a lot of the great happiness that I'm currently feeling right now.
That's Liz Moore. She's a writer, and her novels include The Unseen World, Heft, and The Words of Every Song. Coming up, Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for The New York Times, on the ways that we talk ourselves out of relationships before they really begin.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with The New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to The New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Dan Jones says that Liz's essay is a reminder of all the practical concerns that can get in the way of love.
There's so many things that can derail a relationship early on, despite your feelings. And you might feel like you have a crush on someone, you might feel like you're falling in love with them, but on the other side of your brain is this sort of practical set of concerns or rationalizations as to why, you know, this can't work. And I wonder how many possible real true loves are derailed because of that. It was just so refreshing to have her battle those rationalizations and then just sort of plow through them and, you know, they make it.
Thanks again to Julia Stiles. She stars in the original series Riviera, which you can see on Sundance Now. Next week, Andrew Rannells from HBO's Girls with a live performance of his own essay about ignoring a string of urgent phone calls during a casual hookup.
Well, I tried to get more information from Doug and what hospital, should I get on a plane? I gestured for Brad to sit down and he started rubbing my back, which felt like torture. I was embarrassed about crying in front of him, but I didn't really care enough to stop. After I hung up, he tried to hug me. What happened? I wanted to shout, "Clearly nothing good. Put on some pants."
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, Amory Sievertson, and Caitlin O'Keefe. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Agnes Chakrabarty. See you next week.